Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on an economist, author, and former assistant to President Trump. And this is the one and only Peter Navarro. Welcome to the show.
Zuby, my buddy. Good to be with you.
No doubt. So I've done a brief intro there, Peter. But for people who may not be familiar with who you are, please tell them a little bit about you.
Well, first of all, I'm the author of this new book called In Trump Time. The subtitle is A Journal of America's Plague Year. For the literati, that's a little homage to Defoe's book about the plague in London. I am one of only three senior White House officials that was with President Donald Trump from the 2016 campaign, actually to the end of it. The In Trump Time book is literally based on a journal that I kept on a daily basis beginning in early 2017, basically to record the history I was going to be a small or large part of, but also to hold a bunch of people accountable. The book itself is both a book of revelations about how what happened in the Trump administration is actually starkly different from what was portrayed in the corporate media. But it's also a book of indictments of people like Anthony Fauci, the Chinese Communist Party, and some of the people actually within the Trump administration who, through their disloyalty to the president, wound up killing people. And behind me, just for your viewers here, this is what I call the house that Tony Fauci built. It's the Wuhan, China bioweapons lab where the pandemic started with Fauci's money and help. And if you want to talk about that, that's one of the things we can dive into at some point.
Absolutely. So how did you first get involved in the Trump administration? How did that come to happen?
That goes back a ways. You know, the first book I wrote, I wrote a trilogy on China based on my observations as an economist that our economy was deteriorating after China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. I noticed a sharp downshift in our economy, and I began studying China. And in that first book, interestingly, Zuby, I actually predicted China would cause a global viral pandemic that would kill millions. Just put that as a footnote in there. But here's the point. In 2011, Donald Trump was asked by some smart-ass reporter at the LA Times what was the books he had read on China. It's smart-ass because they were trying to catch him in a Sarah Palin moment, thinking he'd go, well, I read them all. And he proceeded with some precision, right, to list like 10 books in order of preference by title and author. And I happen to be number six on what would be the president's favorite list of China books. And I began corresponding with him through his executive assistant, Rona Graff. He would write me little notes in the margin, this, that, and the other thing. So when the campaign rolled around and I saw he was running, for me, I understood better than most that he was one of the few people in America that understood the importance of blue collar manufacturing, of bringing our jobs home from the sweatshops of Asia. And I told him at that point, whatever I could do, I'd be happy to help him. So it wasn't long before I was working on the campaign, helping with some of the speeches, and eventually wound up at Trump Tower in the War Room as his top economic and trade advisor. And then as soon as when he got elected, it was natural for me to roll into the White House with him.
What was it like working with President Trump? Because, as you know, he's a very polarizing figure. I know everybody knows people on both sides of this. But what was it like as someone who worked alongside him for many years?
Well, I wish people knew him like I do. I mean, the first thing that I always noticed was well, I guess what you'd call the commoner's touch, where he was always so respectful to ordinary working people. I'd see that the interactions in so many different ways. You know, he'd be very sharp with the Wall Street tycoons that would come in and rip them a new one, but never with normal working people. The second thing is he's funny. I mean, sitting in the Oval Office with the trade team that we do regularly, it's, you know, funny, charming, but here's, I think, the most important thing. I always saw him as playing like four-dimensional chess. It's like a lot of perception of the administration was chaos from the outside, but it was always a strategic kind of chaos that he would create to advance a goal that he would see. And I'll give you an example, Zuby. It's like when he ran for office, and this is all in the In Trump Time book, I talked about the seven deadly sins of China's economic aggression, stuff like stealing our intellectual property and killing people with fentanyl. It's like he understood all of that. And he, what he wanted to do to defend ourselves was slap tariffs on them. But when we first got there, that was controversial. I thought it's like, go sudden zen, just do it. But his attitude was, well, we're going to give the Chinese a shot at maybe making amends here, right? So what happened over a period of like a year and a half, it's like every time we let them try to make amends, they'd screw us. And that basically allowed us to begin putting tariffs on gradually, even as public opinion swung sharply in our favor. And so that was the kind of, I mean, that wouldn't have occurred to me. And I'm kind of like a straight ahead kind of guy. It's like, hey, they're screwing us, slap the tariffs on. His was like, we'll do what called the dragon, what I call in the In Trump Time book, the dragon in a pot strategy, which was to do it slowly. And so we can like boil them alive before they realized it, because we knew they'd screw us.
I hear that. And your book, you talk a lot about what happened with the ongoing pandemic situation. So what did that look like as an insider from early on?
Yeah, let me start with chapter one of In Trump Time. I call it the Red Wedding chapter, in homage to Game of Thrones. As I told you earlier, I had written a book and was well aware of China's potential to cause a pandemic. And it's January 15, 2020. I'm seeing the cable traffic on what's happening in Wuhan. I'm watching the crematory on satellite images where they're burning bodies over time. And I'm sitting in the East Wing with the president. He's on stage with these Chinese diplomats signing what I call the skinny trade deal. A pale shadow of what we really wanted. But I'm sitting there like, Zuby, I'm in a cold sweat. I don't sweat a lot, but that day I was in a cold sweat thinking a number of things. It's like, what do these Chinese communists know about the virus that they're not telling us? Could they be infected? And if so, why'd they shake my hand last night at dinner? And what are they doing sitting so close to the president? But mostly as like visions of like Chernobyl and Pearl Harbor and the Twin Towers are going through my head, I'm thinking, could this be a bioweapon that China has unleashed upon America to take down the only president that has stood up to them? And then, you know, that's like January 15th. And then fast forward a mere 2 weeks, in chapter two, I'm in the Situation Room doing hand-to-hand combat with Fauci, who's telling everybody in the room not to impose a travel ban on China. He's not taking the virus seriously. He's the health guy. I'm the economist. I'm taking it seriously. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, it's like, and I actually said this to him, it's like, you really want to bring 20,000 Chinese nationals in a day, many from Wuhan, lit up like a Christmas tree with virus? Is that your position? And Zuby, I knew right then that guy was going to be trouble, that he thought he was smarter than he was. And he wound up doing tremendous damage. And just let me walk you through this. This is I call this the wing. This is the wing that of the Fauci wing of the house that Fauci built. Here's what we knew at the end of January. We knew that the virus came from Wuhan, right? That it popped up within a few hundred yards of this lab. So right off the bat, it should tell you it's not from nature, it's from the lab. We knew, we didn't know, but Fauci knew that he had actually funded this lab research with these so-called gain-of-function experiments, which can turn harmless bat viruses into human killers. Fauci knew that. He wasn't telling us. And he'd already been told by a prominent scientist that the virus itself was genetically engineered. Here's my point, Zuby. You asked me kind of what it was like in the early days. What Fauci should have done then, and it was a huge lie of omission, he should have come clean. He should have said, hey, you know what, Mr. President, this thing might actually be a possibly weaponized virus from this lab. And I'll tell you, Zuby, if I had known that, if the boss had known that, if the task force had known that, we would have had a completely different strategy that would likely have saved millions of lives worldwide. But he didn't do that. And then from there, in the Trump Time book, I go into like talking about how I went from the trade and economic advisor for 3 years to effectively the quartermaster in the war against the virus, because I was the guy who in February began making sure we all had all the PPE we needed. I wrote some significant memos about moving along the vaccine and the therapeutics. And, it was quite a sleigh ride for me, but it needed to be done. And I was one of the few people in the White House, the president, me, and security advisor Robert O'Brien, were really the only three people in the White House who were taking the pandemic seriously early on.
Mm. And what is it that gave you that insight to be able to do that? Because if I'm remembering back to that time frame, that's when, I mean, I know people were seeing various videos coming out of China.
Yeah.
But the World Health Organization was also saying that there's no human-to-human transmission.
Yep.
There was a little bit of talk about it maybe coming from a lab, but the prevailing theory was that this came from a bat or a pangolin or something like that. So what was the info that you had there?
I think it was my deep knowledge of China and the Chinese Communist Party, based on the trilogy of books that I had written prior to coming to the White House. Remember, The Coming China Wars, 2006, there's a whole chapter in there about how China has become effectively a laboratory for the creation of toxic viruses and fungus and all manner of diseases. So that's kind of the baseline. And then the second book, Death by China, subtle title there. I got to understand just how devious these people in the Chinese Communist Party are, and how much they really do want to take down America. And then the third book, the Crouching Tiger, is about the Chinese military, right? And the use of things like the hypersonic vehicles, but also bioweapons. So all of that, that plus me sitting there, right, in the East Wing, knowing that the Wuhan crematoria are burning overtime. I mean, there was no question in my mind at the end of January that thing came from the Wuhan lab, and that we had a pandemic on our hands. And look, the World Health Organization was not credible. I mean, I've written extensively about how Tedros, the guy who ran it, is in hock to the Chinese Communist Party through his Ethiopian connection. So we weren't going to get the truth out of them. Fauci himself had a vested interest in lying by omission about the lab origins of the virus. And Zuby, the one thing that really was so disappointing, I'd sit there in the Oval Office with the president, and he'd sit behind the Resolute desk, and he'd have Fauci there. He'd have Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. He'd have Hahn from the FDA. He'd have Redfield from the CDC. And he'd look at him, and he'd say, all right, what do we got and what do we do, right? And these were the people, Zuby, who were in government and were supposed to have prepared for the possibility of a pandemic. And when they asked him when President Trump asked them that question, they had nothing. They had nothing. And they should have kept their mouth shut in public. But instead, even though they had nothing to give the president, they went out and worked to undermine him, particularly Fauci, because, I mean, look, what is he? The top economic health advisor for Biden. OK, what does that tell you? OK, fifth column. He was working for Biden and the Democrats all along. And there's a reason why he's the highest paid bureaucrat in D.C. and one of the longest serving ones. He knows how to play the game.
Well, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. So what are some things that, of course, I'm sure some of the listeners are going to want to check the book out. But what are some things in the book that you can reveal on this podcast which you think will surprise people? What are some things that are truly things that just aren't out there but people should know?
Well, I think the depth of the evilness of Tony Fauci, I mean, he literally belongs in a jail cell. I think the underlying truth about how prepared we were to fight the pandemic early on, contrasted against the kind of the lost February narrative and how we were caught back on our heels. I completely dispel that myth based on the actual memos that I wrote and actions that we took. I mean, think about it. I write a memo on February 9th that says we can get a vaccine done by October or November. And guess what? We got a vaccine done by November. I mean, that doesn't happen by accident. And by the way, Fauci said it would take 2 years. So I think that's going to be an important revelation. And then everything that's about the election integrity, I make the very strong case that this election was indeed stolen in the battleground states in a thousand different ways, and that we need to get to the bottom of that.
Okay. So in terms of the way that the pandemic situation was handled, if you could go back in time, what would you have suggested be done differently in the USA?
Well, the most important thing was the big lie of omission. I mean, again, I go to the house that Fauci built. Please understand, as everybody watching and listening to this, Tony Fauci knew as early as late January 2020 that this virus was likely a genetically engineered bioweapon that was going to cause a pandemic. He knew that. And if he had told us that, we would have been able to take extraordinarily different measures to control that. So there's blood on his hands. I think people need to hold China, communist China, responsible. I calculate in the In Trump Time book, $20 trillion at a minimum of a bill, a year's worth of GDP that we've lost already, and we're still counting to this virus. It's completely disrupted and dismantled large sections of our economy. And I think, look, it's a book of revelations, but it's also a book of indictments. There were a lot of people that I worked shoulder to shoulder with that really let the president down, whether it was Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, or Kudlow, National Economic Council Director, virus deniers and people who constantly disobeyed the president, Mulvaney, feckless chief of staff. I'm trying to write a book of truth and basically have a situation where I speak truth to power. I like to say the book is whiskey, no chaser, big truth to power. And the epilogue of the book basically sets forth a way forward in a world which I regard now as very dangerous, both economically and militarily.
Mm. So in terms of the response itself, what do you think should have been done differently or could have been with that information?
Well, the original sin of the pandemic was Fauci's lie of omission. What we would and could have done was put the wrath of God and pressure on the communist Chinese to disclose the exact genome of the virus and know exactly what we were fighting against. That would have helped us get to a more effective vaccine quicker. It would have we would have been able to avoid some of the measures we took in the fog of war, and we would have been able to hold them accountable. So, you know, in the woulda, shoulda, coulda, that to me was the original sin. It was the original sin of Tony Fauci. I think with respect to the vaccine and therapeutics, there's a chapter seven. It's the longest chapter in the book. It's an homage to Perry Mason. It's the scurrilous case of hydroxyhysteria. If, you know, Zuby, if I say hydroxychloroquine to you, there's going to be a lot of people listening who think that that's a dangerous drug that doesn't work, that can kill people. And it's just the opposite. That was a myth created by Fauci and CNN, Zucker, and the left-wing media, simply because President Trump said it might work. And the game afoot was to blame Trump rather than China, with Fauci the one basically being the saint to take on the devil Trump. But hydroxychloroquine, if I could wave one magic wand, I would have a policy where therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin would have been allowed to be used in off-label use to people in the first 7 days of their infection, what we call early treatment use. Now, unfortunately, long after the time it was most needed, still needed now, but we know from hundreds of thousands of data points that if you take hydroxychloroquine, which, by the way, pregnant women are recommended to take if they go into malaria zones, yeah, how dangerous is that? If you take it, Zuby, in the first 7 days of your infection, the science data tells us that you will have more moderate symptoms, number one, less time in the hospital if you wind up there, less chance you'll have to go on a ventilator, and largely it takes death off the table. And so if you look at the more than 600,000 Americans that have died from this Fauci Communist Chinese Party virus, I deeply, deeply have sorrow about the fact that I was unable to win the hydroxy hysteria wars, because there would be over 300,000 Americans alive today if those therapeutics had been allowed by the FDA and Fauci to be readily dispensed by personal physicians. It's a true tragedy.
Yeah, it's been a big shame the way that the whole thing got politicized very, very early and beyond any sort of bioweapon potential. It was clearly used also as a political weapon, specifically in the USA in terms of the response.
Yes, yes, indeed. And hydroxy is used worldwide with great effect. A lot of the frontline workers, nurses and doctors take hydroxy as a prophylactic. And, you know, I had, you know, one of the interesting things, Zuby, is I, as the Defense Production Act policy coordinator, I had at my fingertips 64 million tablets of hydroxy that I could dispense through FEMA in a matter of hours anywhere in the country. And because of the hydroxy hysteria, I could not do that. And that was enough to treat 4 million Americans and save 50,000 lives alone. And again, it was one of the great sorrows that I wasn't able to beat the Fauci wing of the administration and Jeff Zucker. Those people have blood on their hands. John Berman at CNN's New Day, Sheryl Stolberg at the New York Times. They did everything they could to discredit a therapeutic. I mean, we've lost over 600,000 American lives. Hydroxychloroquine hasn't killed anybody. I mean, it's absurd what happened, and I have deep regret about not being able to win that battle.
I hear that. Peter, I know you've got to jump onto another interview, so I want to be respectful of your time. But if people want to find out more about you or the book, what's the best place for them to go?
Well, I would ask everybody to go right now to Amazon, buy the book, get some for your friends, particularly the ones who are never Trumpers. It's an important historical document that really is in the definitive insider's account. You can also go to my website, peternavarro.com, where there's a lot of information about the book, and Real P. Navarro on both Getter and Twitter is a source where I have daily updates. But Zuby, I can't thank you enough for your time today. And the next time we book this, if you want me back, I'll go as long as you want. But the book came out yesterday, and it's a busy time here, and I'm trying to do my best.
That's all good, Peter. I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, it's great talking to you, man.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.